Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of August 25th, 2017. Can you believe it? Closing in on the end of summer. Today, we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Glad to have you with us. And we're also joined by author and climate hawk, Miss Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. It's good to have you both here. One of these days I'm going to introduce you first, Mariah, just to change things up, just so that we go out of a different pattern. Speaking of different patterns, or maybe predictable patterns, this past week saw the a celestial event, and I won't... Did you listen to Pod Save America? I mean, they every time they said eclipse in their Pod Save America, they went to the song about total eclipse of the heart.
Yeah, that was hysterical.
Anyway, there was an eclipse this week. So did you guys see the eclipse?
I did.
Did you? You did not? Why? No. Were you on strike? You were trying to deny the reality of solar photons?
I wasn't going to risk my eyesight. And I didn't have the glasses.
All right. And Mariah, what did you see it?
Yeah, I was down. I went down Salem. I live near Salem, and they did a nice little event down there where they were giving out glasses. Mm-hmm. One per party, you know. But I got to see it, and I got to see it when it reached, I think, about 63%. And yeah. There was this kind of eerie silver light. All around.
It was fun. In my, of course, the play, I work at sort of a tech kind of company. And, of course, one of the other PhD guys comes out with this little handmade pinhole camera that he had in a shoebox, right, with a piece of aluminum foil with a real pin in it, and you could look through it, and it was a perfect image of the thing, right, completely safe. And they were handing out the ISO glasses, which protect your eyes, and of course that engendered a bunch of discussions whether or not they were fake or real. But I too looked up and could see. It was pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. But I guess the question is, tell me, Mariah, it happened at a predictable time, right?
Yeah.
Why was that? So just exactly why did we know that?
Right. Well, it's this crazy thing called science, which I happen to believe in. And I think Progress did an article about how, you know, the whole country was rushing to these places that were in the path of the, you know, the full eclipse to really get the full sense of it.
The totality.
The totality, yeah, that's it. And how they all knew it because, you know, the scientists had told them, the scientists study this information and had compiled the information and had done predictions about when it was going to happen. And they believed those predictions. They believed those models. They believed that science. And
that mysterious thing that they couldn't really put their hand on, right?
Yeah. And just, you know, putting that in juxtaposition with the climate science, which is equally as robust and equally as clear, and yet there's this really interesting denial of it.
It really does tell you something about the human choice involved in climate. Ignorance is the wrong word. Climate choosing not to know, all right? Choosing not to believe, even if you're not passionate, right? You're just about denying science. You're like, you don't want to know, and you can ignore it because of some part of your psyche that works better if you just choose not to believe. And when you want to believe, when it's convenient, then you will drive to Columbia, South Carolina to see the totality, right?
Right.
I don't know. Well, I guess the article that I saw, which caught my eye, was an aspect that I had not thought about. And, of course, again, it's in Think Progress. But it's the idea that if you were a critic of solar power, this would be a great opportunity to say, look how the electric grid collapsed when the moon went over the sun. And, of course, the electric grid did not collapse. mostly right. due to the fact that the science made the solar eclipse so predictable. Everyone knew exactly when things were going to happen, so the grid had survived it. But it is an interesting, you know, way to look at it. It's like the denial of sunlight didn't make any difference, right? The world kept marching forward. I think there was something that said by 2024 there's going to be another eclipse, and you know, at some point, I think we've talked on this show, at some point the intermittency question becomes more important, right? If you have 30, 40, 50% solar panels, then you got to be more thoughtful about how to manage it, which you can do. But we'll have another big test, I think it's in 2024, when totality passes over the Boston area, right?
Mm-hmm.
That'll
right,
be interesting.
Right.
That'll be interesting. Well, anyway, the eclipse didn't eclipse my my faith in science at all. If anything, it reinforced it, right? So there you go. Speaking of I don't know, predictable things, we have spoken many times in this show about a company called ExxonMobil and its role in basically trying to confuse the public, right? This goes back to this idea of the people who believed in the eclipse and the people who don't believe in climate change. ExxonMobil has, for a long time, really tried to obscure scientific fact. And I know, DR, you've been quite adamant about that on various shows. But there was an article that I saw in the Boston Globe this morning about a scientific or a formal social sciences study of ExxonMobil's publications that relate to climate change, and to try basically did the corporation tell the truth, right? Mariah, did you see that article? What's the story there?
I did, yeah. I read the article as well as the study that was in the Environmental Research Letters by Jeffrey Supran and Naomi Oreskes, and the first thing from the study, which they pulled this out of the paper. The Oreskes paper, that they said, you know, all these findings that show how much internally ExxonMobil was really saying that climate change is happening and let's plan for it and let's, you know, shape our company's direction
right,
around
our corporate
climate
success.
Change.
Yeah.
And then how externally they were saying it's not, they were saying there's so much doubt, we really don't know. And, you know, here's an example finding from the paper. It said 83% of, a quote, 83% of peer-reviewed papers and 80% of internal documents acknowledge that climate change is real and human-caused, yet only 12% of the advertorials, which are these paid editorial-style advertisements, say that it's really human caused, with 81% instead expressing doubt. So even though 83% internal focus was saying it's real, you've got just the opposite saying it's not. Mm-hmm. And the reason they studied these advertorials is because they come directly from ExxonMobil, and they are unequivocally public forms of communication designed to affect public opinion or official opinion. So, you know, ExxonMobil is putting these out, and they're very intentionally designed to shape opinion, and they're shaping it in the direction of doubt.
Right. So I mean, what I found interesting in because I read the piece in the Globe, and they were quite. The authors of the paper were quite clear that they used formal analysis methods. So it was not like a reporter counting up, you know, how many climate change references were in an advertisement somewhere. They used these methods that are well understood within the social sciences to analyze the language, right? And to come up with these numbers of 80% internal agreement that climate change was real and 80% external denial that climate change was real. I mean, those are based on scientific principles, right? I mean, it's not opinion on the part of Supran and Oreskes, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I actually, the methodology in the paper is fascinating. They, you know, they actually were, I would say they were conservative, I think, in a lot of their analysis. They had bins that they created to accommodate reasonable doubt because, you know, up until the 1990s, they exempted expressions of doubt that anthropogenic global warming was real because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change hadn't actually confirmed that it was real until 1990. Mm-hmm. So up till then, they allowed for there to be sort of reasonable doubt in regards to anthropogenic global warming being real. And then after that, they said that there should be more concrete statements around that. And then same with 1995, the Intergovernmental Panel, the IPCC, mm-hmm. confirmed that climate change was human caused. And so before 1995, they allowed for reasonable expressions of doubt about it being human caused. And after 1995, they did not. So the
that's despite the internal documentation that was saying global warming is real. In the external stuff, the authors of the study gave Exxon a pass because the IPCC hadn't publicly, you know, been as strong, right?
Right, exactly. I think that's about right, where they, you know, they really allowed, they know that science is not always 100% concrete. And so they allowed for that wiggle room of, you know, there is always some expressions of reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think they were conservative and, you know, I think one thing to emphasize with their paper is that they were not necessarily trying to study whether or not ExxonMobil was saying that the science was false, but they're really studying whether they promoted doubt about it in their advertorials.
Right. And they basically concluded that they had, right? The sort of doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, they say unequivocally, given this discrepancy, we conclude that ExxonMobil misled the public.
Wow. So, I mean, DR, I know you've thought a lot about this. I mean, what are the implications of, if we take this article at face value and the fact that 80% of the time Exxon essentially, not to put too fine an edge on it, but Exxon lied 80% of the time about climate change, what are the implications for these various kinds of lawsuits and things that are going on?
Well, it's interesting that David Roberts, in his piece analyzing the study, noted towards the end, quote, "Whether any of this constitutes legal liability is a question neither the researchers nor I are equipped to adjudicate," unquote. And I thought that was very interesting in light of what I expect to be a defense of Exxon that you're going to see from Exxon's cheerleaders, which is the idea that they're under no legal obligation or no moral obligation either to you know, represent truth to the public. And I went back to this great 2014 piece by Brad Friedman about a controversy that's a nearly century-old controversy in a lawsuit known as Dodge versus Ford Motor Company, mm-hmm. in which the Michigan Supreme Court ruled, quote, "A business corporation is organized and carried on primarily for the profit of the stockholders. The powers of the directors are to be employed for that end," unquote. So the Michigan Supreme Court ruled back then that a corporation was under no legal obligation whatsoever to the public as a general rule, no legal obligation to be altruistic in any way. Its only obligation was to its shareholders to maximize profit. So therefore, you can easily see Exxon's defenders, and we may well see some of Exxon's defenders among the judges who hear some of these cases, mm-hmm. basically saying that, hey, whatever ExxonMobil did, there is a, Even though it's not enshrined into law, this was not a U.S. Supreme Court decision, just a Michigan Supreme Court decision. Nevertheless, there is a certain, shall we say, a dominant vision or a dominant attitude or a dominant view that whatever ExxonMobil did was simply in service of maximizing profits, and therefore they can't be punished now for what they were doing then. This goes to the argument that you often hear, saying that it wasn't as clear cut what mm-hmm. Exxon did, similar to what the tobacco industry did, that the tobacco industry was engaging in blatant illegality, and with what Exxon did, according to Exxon's defenders, it was a bit more hazy and
legal. It just irks me, this idea that, you know, corporations want to have free speech and be people when it's convenient, but then when it's inconvenient and they get to sort of claim the ability to tell lies without, because they're not really people, they're just a corporation. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking, speaking of speech and lies, you know, going back, and as the researchers noted that these advertorials ran from 1972 to 2001 in the New York Times, and because during that time the New York Times reported on the facts of what the science said, we do have to ask, why the hell did the New York Times choose to run these advertorials? Why would they choose to run deliberately lie? Now, of course, if you go back to old 1970s and 1980s, they're running tobacco advertising too, so we can question that. But why would they run those advertorials to begin with?
Money.
Yeah, that's, I tell you, well, all right, so look, very interesting piece of work, and probably something that will stand the test of time and be used in other cases, in other circumstances. This is a great piece of solid scientific, I mean, beyond the Inside Climate News reporting that Exxon was, you know, talking out of both sides of his mouth. This is a scientific study that studies that, and that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's put down this all this heavy-duty science stuff for a minute and talk about TV. you may have heard, if I had the moxie, I'd hum the theme song, but I'm not that good. But Game of Thrones is a TV show that you may have heard of. Have you guys heard of Game of Thrones?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have. I have not seen it, but I've heard of it. I've heard a lot about it.
We should all stipulate, the three of us, as not being big Game of Thrones fans, right? I've only seen mm-hmm. scattering of episodes. Some people I love are really into Game of Thrones. But of course, Game of Thrones, if you haven't seen it, it's kind of a modernized Lord of the Rings thing, where, you know, lots of dragons and spiritual things and swords and chopping people's heads off and all. And of course, different from the Lord of the Rings, I guess there's lots and lots of nudity in Game of Thrones. But Game of Thrones this week, after seven seasons, I guess the sixth show of the seventh season, finally got around to grappling with one of the underlying themes that has been hidden behind all that nudity for the last 6 years. And that is whether or not Game of Thrones is a climate fiction piece. Get that, climate fiction. You may not have thought of it that way. But so I'm going to assume that, dear listener, you have not seen the show either. You can send in your comments if you want. But long and short of it, the Game of Thrones is set kind of in a place like England, medieval England. There's a lot of people running around in the southern part of this island with intrigue and trying to take over the kingship, right? Back and forth, infighting, treachery, lies, deceit, all this kind of stuff. But at the northern edge of that kingdom, approximately where I imagine Scotland would be, right, it's all snowy winter. And there's this whole thing about, there's this line of forts where the good guys are basically standing watch against this scary bunch of people that live north of the wall in this wintry thing. And of course, the headline, you know, winter is coming, is this common theme. And the whole point is that there's one family that guards this wall that can see these white, what are called the White Walkers, which are these scary zombie guys walking around in the snow. And they know that the White Walkers are getting ready to invade across the wall into the south, where everyone's, you know, being nude and killing each other, right? And having all these intrigues. Huh? And they don't believe that the White Walkers are north of the border. And so the show is finally getting around to the point of trying to get one of the good guy characters is trying to capture one of these zombie White Walker guys to bring down and convince everybody that the threat is real, right? And if you haven't caught on to the climate change analogy there, right? I mean, it's obvious, right? That climate change represented by the scary snow people are not accepted as being real. And in this last show, the pretty queen who rides the dragon around finally went up north into the snow and now believes in the White Walkers. But I guess that aside, the question is, what's the role of something like a show that credibly deals with climate change, even in a metaphorical way? Is that a useful thing? I mean, there are other books, Mariah, I know you've read other books. I mean, Game of Thrones, put Game of Thrones aside. Where does climate change fit into our artistic vision? How do we process this issue, right? That's a jump really ball. You got me. I mean, for example, I've read some books. I was listing them up before. I read a book called, The Dog Star. Have you seen it? It's just this story about this guy. He's like the last guy, and he's got an airplane that he flies around, and everything is deserted. And, you know, he's trying to find his humanity in this climate-ravaged future. And there's a book called The Water Knife, which is about the American Southwest in, 60 or 70 years, where the water knife is a guy who is an agent of the water company. And, of course, you can't live without water, and he's sort of this criminal gangster type, right? And I just think that these books are going to become, these artistic endeavors become more and more important as climate change becomes more and more credible, right? Have you read any climate change books or climate fiction?
I have. So Kim Stanley Robinson has a trilogy, 40 Signs of Rain, and then, 50 Degrees of Something and 60 Something. So, mm-hmm. It's right, three right, different right. books. And they really investigate a lot about sort of science and doubt and the scientific process, and they're interesting. I enjoyed them. Mm-hmm. I remember reading something somewhere about how a lot of horror movies will reflect whatever the current sort of fear is. Mm-hmm. It'll just sort of make that into a hyperbole and turn it into a horror movie. You know, we have a lot of these like robot cyber horror films right now.
Well, I mean, all the those Japanese horror movies from the 1950s, mm-hmm. right? From that you mm-hmm. probably saw late night TV, right? If Godzilla isn't the atomic bomb coming to rework Tokyo one more time, right? I mean, so mm-hmm. you're quite right. All the what were the movies in the 70s about the children that were the devilish children, right? You guys weren't mm-hmm. even born yet, but I mean, again, it was a time when the youth culture was threatening the world, and so what was the worst imaginable thing is having a child whose eyes glowed in the dark and would kill you when mm-hmm. you weren't looking. So I mean, your point being that you're right, this stuff is in the zeitgeist, right? The fear.
Right. And I'm happy to see that the Game of Thrones, whoever's creating the game, the producers are going down this route, that are bringing this maybe to something people will talk about a little bit, this cli-fi kind of
and I guess it's aim. To my mind, if you see something like that and you, even if you don't consciously make the connection, I mean, it's in your head that this sort of deliberate ignorance of a threat, deliberately ignoring a threat and the political fallout from that, right? And I think people, even if they don't know it, might begin to view reality a different way. It might look on events of, our president saying crazy things in a different way.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I guess that's our literary discussion for this week. The book, the Climate Climate Hawks Book Club will adjourn this meeting. But if anyone out there has read any climate fiction that they're interested in, the thing people ought to know about, send it in. It'd be interesting. I mean, I think it's a great topic because it goes beyond. I guess the other thing I was thinking was, you've seen The Day After Tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. Which was this sort of wacky climate change movie where it was all about, the Arctic coming down into the United States. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if really the representation of climate change is easier in a literary sense if it's cold instead of hot. Somehow mm-hmm. people react more, they're more frightened of cold than they are of warmth, which is, maybe mm-hmm. that makes sense, but it's just, mm. it keeps coming up as cold as being the anti-metaphor for climate change. Anyway, we'll put that mm-hmm. down. Hey, look, guys, we will try to put up some links. Mariah has been doing a fantastic job. You should all send her a thank you note for the wonderful transcript she's been mm-hmm. making up. So that's good. We'll put that up on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can get to the page through our Facebook page at /massclimateaction. Of course, you can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, and all the yada yada other directories. And of course, you can find us on iTunes. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. And remember, winter is coming. So thanks very much for being here, Niar.
Thanks.
And Mariah, thank you so much for chatting.
Happy to be here.
We'll talk to you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.